Okay, we're glad to have you with us today. We're looking at, on page 21, and I put this part in. I only teach this part when I'm teaching this here at the college because all the reasons are obvious. Now, for those of you who are already married, I expect you to be my amen corner.
Amen.
And the rest of you, I think this is very valuable. I'm serious. The difficulty, we're talking about preparing for marriage. And some of you are preparing for marriage in this class, and some of you will be preparing for marriage. If you can find anybody silly enough to have you. First of all, I point to the difficulties created by the modern engagement. Now, when I say modern engagement, I want you to realize, and you surely do have picked up on this by now, that the modern engagement period, usually lasting for several months, is a historical aberration. That is not the way most peoples have done it. By that I mean, first of all, unmonitored togetherness is a historical aberration. Where you had engagements, and sometimes we look at these marriage contracts or betrothals that were made sometimes when the children were born or the children were very young, and they would be betrothed for several years. It would be a legally binding arrangement between families. What has not been a part of most cultures is, and not of our culture until recent times, really until after the First World War, is unmonitored togetherness. Now, what unmonitored, you know what I mean by that? That's a fancy way of saying, well, you have a lot of time together, alone. Now, it was considered untoward, considered unwise and unhealthy and immoral in our culture until the middle of this century. Now, that does create problems. I'm not categorically condemning that. I'm simply saying it creates problems. Now, and I think most of us know the nature of those problems. What happens is, it's created by, well, let me be systematic about this, as I say in the syllabus, the trend toward marrying at a later age. And this, and interestingly enough, it's growing. It's getting even later now. As you know, let me approach it this way. Historically, by the time a people, especially girls, especially females, were physically ready for marriage, marriage began to take place. So about marriage of a girl who's 13, 14. Well, that's different than a girl who, and of course boys would be somewhat older, but still nearer, in many cases, this age. Most of the pressure came on women because men were not, in many cultures, were not really expected to be virgins at marriage, whereas women were. This is this unequal standard. And we still have vestiges of that in our culture. It's completely unbiblical. It's unfair, but it's true. We still have leftovers of that. You got that? That is a boy. In fact, it was considered in our culture, so the under-the-table culture, it was considered smart for a boy to be experienced sexually so he could teach his wife. But she had to be a virgin. And this is still a part of the cultural mood. It is common for boys, for men, to want to... During their high school years, later high school years, and college years, to, as they say, mess around. But when it comes time to marry, they don't want to marry the girls have been messing around with. They want to find a girl that hadn't been messing around. They want to find a virgin to marry. And that is very much in the thinking of modern so-called so-called informed males, today's so-called modern males. You all recognize that, don't you? That's still there. It's dying out some, but it's still there. There's still this uneven standard. And so most of the pressure came on girls. But still, there was this unmonitored togetherness. And it's interesting. So what I'm saying is, for both, but especially for girls, because of this uneven and unfair and unbiblical cultural pressure. When you have the gap between the time when a person is physically ready for marriage, for sex, they can have children, they can establish a home, and the gap between that time when they are physically ready, are capable, and when they actually get married, this gap in modern times has lengthened. You understand? Whereas in ancient times, most practices were, the gap was very small. And interestingly enough, it's widening again. That is, there was a period in Western culture, let's talk about America, when we went from in some cases, with girls in the back countries, younger marriages, but couples got married older, then they got married younger, and now they're getting married older again. You realize that the average age of marriage today is about 2 years beyond what it was when I was where you were. So it's primarily because of economics and the requirements of education. You understand that those are the primary two. That is, it was when you're at your grandparents' age, only the wealthy went to college. Most people didn't go to college. What did that mean? Most of the people didn't finish high school. That meant they would work on the farm. You didn't have to have a high school education to work on the farm, or even to get the job at the factory. So they got, by the time they were 17, 16, 17, 18, they had jobs, and they got married. Now, where college is almost a requirement, where most go to college, or at least a good many go to college, then this is delayed. And even if they don't go to college, they have some kind of training. And so that delays it. And modern moral relativism delays it. That is, people are more willing to have sex and do have sex before marriage. It's very common today for a couple to be engaged and have sex all through their engagement. You know that, don't you? It's very common. So, but what's happening is that when you have this widened gap between when you're physically ready for marriage and when you actually get married, it doesn't create pressure on the couple who does not follow God's way, because they simply have sex all through the engagement period. But for Christian couples, somebody who tries to do it the way God says to do it, it puts real pressure on a couple.
Amen. This is your engagement point.
Oh, okay, amen. Thank you. And let's be honest about it. And it has nothing to do with spirituality. As a matter of fact, we're going to see this later, that the closer a couple is spiritually, the more the pressure is on them. Now, what happens is here are the dangers of this. First of all, if a couple gets physical too much too soon, then it really, what happens is, when you have a relationship where there is not marriage, you're not living together and working and developing a life together, when a couple gets, let me make it a matter of degrees, the more physical a couple gets during the engagement period, the less their true relationship gets a chance to develop, because the physical part becomes the center of their relationship. They don't really talk, get to know each other, explore things together, about their dreams, their ideas. They tend to make out. And that's very bad. Secondly, a long engagement period brings all kinds of pressures. Because, you see, look what I say here. The engagement is a time of sexual ambivalence. You know what ambivalence means? You're neither one, neither fish nor fowl. That is, an emotional commitment that is not complemented by a legal commitment. Now, tune me in, students. It creates real pressures on an engaged couple. When you have the ring, are they married? No, they're not married. Are they single? Not really. You see, there's a semi-legal, there's an emotional commitment that does not quite match the legal commitment. And so what happens is, when we say, okay, we're going to be married, we're engaged, we're no longer single in the full sense of the term, right? Well, what happens is, that very commitment increases pressure towards sexual or physical fulfillment. It makes you that much closer. And this sense of commitment adds the pressure. And many give into it, unfortunately. And what it does, and again, couples who really don't mean to go too far do. Now, you understand? The engagement, the very fact of the engagement, this emotional commitment, and where we have a ring, it creates, as I say here, a feeling of intimacy, a sense of belonging to one another, that cries out for fulfillment. Now, sexual anxiety overshadows other considerations in the engagement period, is what I've said. Now, what do we do about this? What do we recommend? Well, we look at the modern cultural acceptance of premarital sex, but we don't accept that. I look here at recurrent psychological problems created by premarital sex for those who have a conscience against it, but who nevertheless engage in sex before marriage. Here's what I mean by that. Now, I don't want to be insensitive about this. I don't want to hurt anybody's feelings, and I certainly have nobody in mind. But I want to teach you this, that I said this earlier when we talk about the nature of sex. We talk about the role it plays in creation. And we talk about the biblical principle of the two become one flesh. And I made the statement that if you have sex with somebody, you carry that person with you the rest of your life. Now, and what happens is that, and this is especially true for women, because women, I'll tell you why later, women are holistic in the way they think. And we'll discuss that later. But it's especially true for females, because men can forget easier. Women can't. And for women, sex is a more general experience. For a man, it's more a more specific experience. And we're going to talk about that later. But here's what I want to say at this point, that if a couple, especially a girl, but not only a girl, if she has sexual intercourse, her first sexual intercourse, with somebody she loves, with somebody she's engaged to, somebody that she is going to marry and does marry, if she has a strong Christian conscience, and it's true for him as well, but especially her, if these people have a strong spiritual, a strong Christian conscience, and yet they succumb to the pressure and have sex before marriage, for them, especially for her, that experience carries with it all kinds of connotations or accompaniments or baggage of guilt and fear. That is, guilt that this is wrong, fear of getting caught, fear of getting pregnant, humiliation afterwards. And what happens is that very often, and I have counseled couples like this, that couples will have premarital sex and feel guilty about it. And here's what they think, especially the girl. Well, as soon as we get married, then we'll have the sex without the guilt and the fear. It will be free of this. And very, very often it isn't. Why? Because you carry everything along with you. And the act of sex, sexual intercourse, becomes associated in the mind with guilt and fear, and it dilutes and pollutes the whole thing. And I have talked with couples, especially girls, who were not able to really have a healthy and fulfilling sexual relationship after they were married, because they found out that the marriage ceremony didn't change a thing. The guilt and fear was right there along with it. Now, I'm not a psychologist, of course, and it doesn't always happen. Maybe I'm oversimplifying it. What I'm saying is, it simply creates real problems. Any questions on this, anybody?
I think you started to touch on it. Maybe you're going to go into it later. that makes it difficult for Christians, especially the long engagement period, is that they have that Christian. They know that they're not going to mess around with anybody else. They know they're committed to one another. So it makes it more difficult. And to pick on somebody who is here in a good way, and I don't know what the reasons were. Jeff and Lori got engaged, and they were married just a few months later. I don't know whether that was even a part of your consideration or not. That makes so much more sense. I think Dean Chambers teaches that too. He says, if you're going to get engaged, once you get engaged, don't have a long engagement. Once you make that decision to keep these sort of things together.
Now, I didn't know he taught that. But as a matter of coincidence, that's exactly my advice. And what happened, you know, I recommend a short engagement period. Even if you know you're pretty well sure you're going to get married, once that ring is given, you're really putting the pressure on yourself. You understand why? You cross the line, a line of commitment, and it creates this sense of intimacy. And I think that's very smart advice. That is, don't get engaged until you're just about ready to get married. Now, what happens to most engagements with Christian couples especially is if they have a long engagement, they spend most of their engagement fighting. One fight after another. Why? Well, because they're frustrated. And little things become big things, and they're tired, and they just fight like cats. I have known marriages or engagements that broke off and did not result in marriage simply because they were too long. I've seen couples, when I was at Cincinnati Bible College, we had a couple or two who you say, well, we got engaged and we'll get married a year from next, you know, it'll be 2 years down the road, and almost invariably they would break up. Why? Well, they just got to fighting so much that they said so many things they didn't really want to say, and the whole thing got poisoned. And I think if they had just gone ahead and got married, they'd had a good marriage. But they just engaged, or this pressure works that way. So now we're going to say more about sex. We're going to study sex in particular. But does this make sense while I'm teaching this principle? I think this, even if you can't have a short, whatever you do, at least if you both recognize what's going on, I think that's a big help. If you say, look, this is what's going on. We're having trouble now because we've been engaged for 6 months, and it's only for 3 months before we get married, and this is the pressure on us. We can talk about it. That helps.
I hope so.
I hope you do.
Well,
we were arguing like that, not all the way down, but we first wanted to see if we got married or not.
And once you got married, it's okay. Yeah. Well, my wife and I were engaged for over a year. We didn't know any better, and it was true. We just fought, you know. We had some big fights, and it was just stupid over, you know. It was not. We loved each other dearly, but it was. It just didn't. You know what I'm saying? It didn't help. It didn't help anything. It didn't help us prepare for marriage. We just did it because we couldn't get. It was a matter of timing and finances and everything. So. Anyway, I got one of my family stories. I got a great uncle who was engaged to a woman for 40 years, and then married her. And they didn't live. They didn't have, as far as we know, they didn't mess around. They were interesting people. They just didn't want to rush into anything. You think that's strange? I had a relative that is a great uncle or a great great uncle, back on my dad's side. I forget the family connection, not real close, I hope. And he was married to this woman who was back in the farm country, back in the hills. He was married to this beautiful woman, and loved her, and just so much in love with her. And believe it or not, it sounds like a story, but it's a sense of traveling. You heard the traveling salesman? This traveling salesman came through and took her with him. And left her husband. Boy, just broke his heart. And so he scouted her out for the ugliest woman he could find. I mean, he found an ugly one. And there was a few of them around. I mean, he found this woman that nobody wanted. And of course, she was tickled to death because she thought she'd never get married. He was never going to have a woman that anybody else would want. And he married her. She's a great lady.
probably would never have got married otherwise. And boy, it's true, nobody else wanted her. And they raised a nice family and had a very happy marriage. And he was sick on death with her. He never worried again. When he went hunting, he knew when he came back she was going to be there. Maybe your wife's ugly. I don't know what the bloodline is, but none of it got into Leslie. But anyway, back to where I was. 40 years is a long time. Well, so is a year. Well, I just mentioned here for future reference the necessary connection between sex and commitment. Okay, any questions on that, on the engagement trip? What do you do? Well, if you're engaged, I think you need to play it smart. Don't use your engagement to mess up your marriage. And it can happen. It can really happen. It takes a lot of smarts. And I think I see a lot of people being smart. I see a lot of people being not so smart. Any other questions or comments? Don't be. I think we're handling this, you know, delicately. We're not trying to be crude, but this is very, very important. Listen, let me go back and emphasize. Make sure you understand this. One of the disadvantages of getting too physical too soon is you don't get to know each other. Okay, I list here inadequate or defective motives for marriage. First of all, loneliness. Bible says God created marriage because it's not good. He saw it was not good for a man to be alone. But loneliness is an inadequate or a defective motive for marriage. That is loneliness by itself. There are a lot worse, you understand? We do get married, we don't want to be alone. But there are a lot worse things than loneliness. Being married to the wrong person is worse than being lonely. And many people simply are lonely. Especially, let me tell you something about people who are especially vulnerable to this. It is young people, these people, and since we're talking about preparing for marriage, they would tend to be young people. And I dare say, I don't want to see any hands or any indications, but I dare say we've got some of those in this room. People who, boys or girls, men or women, who do not grow up with a close family, they tend to grow up lonely. They tend to get sexually involved too early and too easily. It's a great pressure because they feel isolated. Understand? They're not close to anybody. And they tend to make bad decisions, people like this, for marriage. That is, how shall I say, a person who is really lonely, but they don't have a real close relationship with their parents or with brothers and sisters, that person, a person who's never known a sense of really belonging to someone, or they've had a weakened sense of belonging because of a family that didn't work too well, that person will very often, when they meet somebody and they're simply close to them, they're not lonely anymore, they will often misidentify that as love. And sometimes it is, and sometimes it isn't. You understand? As the first time they're not lonely anymore, they want to get married. And we need to be aware of that. Any questions on that? What I'm saying is this, if you have a sense of being lonely, be careful. Be careful. There are worse things than being lonely. Second, the desire to escape parental control. This is especially true of girls in our culture traditionally, but boys as well. That is, I'm going to get married. Why? To get out of the house. And I'm not making this up. This happens. Boy, and I've seen couples who did it. I've seen girls married the first thing that came along on two legs because it was a way out from under. It was a way to get away from dad or mom. And that's very bad. There are worse. You understand? If you want to get away from parental control, do it some other way than just marry the first person who will take you away from that. And that is a real problem. A real problem. And it's getting more of a problem. Third, y'all stop me if you have any questions or comments on these. We're moving right along. Third is social acceptance, an inadequate or defective motive for marriage. That is, what do I mean by that? Social acceptance. What does that say to you?
Everyone
else? All my friends are getting married. Boy, I hate to be left out. You know? But she says, I've been a bridesmaid 3 times. Next time I'm going to be the bride. I'm tired of always being the one who's not in the white dress. Social acceptance. And that happened. And listen to me closely. That is the pressure to get married for social acceptance is especially intense at a Bible college, at a small Bible college. Why? Because you tend to make closer friends at a small Bible college. The comparisons are there. And it's very hard for someone, especially boys and girls. I think girls maybe more than others, maybe not. It doesn't make a difference. To see, maybe you've got 5 or 6 close friends and you're the last one. And all of a sudden you find that they're off doing things that you're not doing because they're married. Married couples tend to be able to do things that don't involve you anymore and so forth. By the way, I mean going this way. We got an engaged person over here who's suffering. I'm saying things like go away for weekends, things like this, and you really feel left out. That's an inadequate or defective motive. Simple sexual attraction is an inadequate or defective motive for marriage. And listen, sexual attraction is a powerful thing. And it often, sexual attraction often appears to be love when it isn't love. And a lot of couples have waked up the morning after the night before and found out, now that they've had sex, that they don't really like each other. Let me say this to you. Fall in like before you fall in love. I've had both of my daughters at various times in the past year say that. I said, honey, are you in love? No, but I'm in like. You know, I'm in a heavy like. Well, that's good. I like that. That encourages me. Because and sexual attraction is confusing and distracting. Any questions? Economic security. Now that because girls today tend to be more independent, that is less a problem, I think, than it has been in the past, and I think that's healthy. But often, people will marry, both men and women, just for economic security, to have an income. I put this one in because I got sick of hearing it. Evangelism. Evangelism is an inadequate or defective motive for marriage. Now this is interesting. I'm delving over into an area in which I'm really not trained, of course. But I think I know what I'm talking about here. This idea of trying to win somebody to the Lord is tricky. I don't know, I'm not sure of all the nuts and bolts of this thing. We had a deacon once in the church where I served who his marriage eventually failed. I tried to put it back together. I did put it back together twice. It couldn't do it a third time. But he got the feeling, he had this lady he worked with, and he got the feeling sorry for her, so he went to her house with some tracts. He was going to win her to the Lord. And evangelism turned to hanky-panky about the second, third visit. And I've seen that happen many, many times. I have seen young men who would pretend to be interested in
in Christ. And lures girls thinking they were... There have been many cases where the girl, or sometimes the boy, girls do this too, works both ways. I just seen more the other way. Let me put it this way, where the Christian thinks they're evangelizing, and what's really happening is they're being seduced. And it happens a lot. Some guys get pretty good at it. There's something about this, especially with girls who really have a missionary spirit. They'll get this guy who's the town bum, good-looking bum, but the town bum anyway. And she really gets this strong feeling that she's going to win him to the Lord no matter what, even if she has to marry him. Now, if you put it to her that way, she doesn't say that. But it often happens exactly that way. Or you say, well, he's a nice guy. I believe thinking, you know, a preacher, why don't you marry me? He's not a Christian. I'm not going to marry you. Well, I'm sure I can win him. My answer is, God has a very excellent plan of winning the lost. It's called evangelism. It's not called marriage. Don't get married to evangelize. Now, sounds at first blush, it may sound like that's a silly, superficial thing to say, but I'm talking about a real situation. And there's something about the psychology of that which is very deceptive. Any questions or comments on that? Okay. Rehabilitation of either. Some people, and especially girls who are of good spirit, they tend to want to view a man as a project. Men don't often do that. That is, boy, I think what I could make of him. Give me a half a chance, and I'll make something out of that old boy. You understand what I'm talking about? Here's the guy who's got some real problems. But boy, if I just, I could marry him, and I can, you just watch what I do with him. Rehabilitation is a bad motive for marriage. Listen, what you marry is what you're going to have. You got that? What you marry is going to... I'll just broaden this a little bit at this point. Make sure you like his folks or her folks. You marry them too. You got that? Right? Anybody think you marry just one person, you don't know what's going on. You marry a family, and you marry what they are, warts and all. And listen, here's the rule, boys and girls, men and women. The warts they got on their wedding day, they're going to have the day you bury them. Pretty much. Maybe some changes, but not very much. And changes will come. But you see, now it's one thing for people, one or both, to change, to improve during marriage. And many do. That is not the same thing as marrying with the idea of rehabilitation. I can't tell you how many Christian girls I've seen whose lives have been ruined because they married a good-looking drunk, but they were really sure that once they got married, they could stop them from drinking. And end up with a terrible time with a drinking father and husband and trying to protect the kids, and it's misery. But they were so sure they could straighten him out. It's not fair anyway. Because usually you don't tell the person, hey, I think you're pretty much the bum. Let me get a hold of you. I'll marry you, and then you'll be my project for the next decade, and I'll get you straightened out. Better to stay, listen to me. If you want to rehabilitate, if you're into rehabilitation, become a nurse or start a construction company. You know, become a physical therapist or restore old houses. Don't try it on people through marriage.
Am I clear on that? Okay. To meet the, I put this in purposely because I teach this in the Bible college. It's an inadequate and defective motive to meet the requirements of a profession. What am I talking about? Well, they're not going to hire me if I don't have a wife. Got to have a wife. Let's see, which one shall I take? Fellas, there have been a lot of successful single preachers. Marry somebody, make sure you love, make sure you marry him for the right reason. Don't marry him because the pulpit committee said, don't marry them because you've had three pulpit committees send back your resume because you're single. You understand that? Right, Book? He's sitting there enthusiastic. I don't know. I just figured you wanted to say something. from the short person? And this is a problem because ministers and young ministers do have a problem. They unfairly get turned down because preachers are often afraid of churches are afraid of a single preacher. Churches are afraid of a single youth minister sometimes. Sometimes they've had reasons to be because they got a youth minister who thinks he's there to date the girl, you know, and that creates, you know, any youth minister who dates a girl in his youth group is asking for real trouble. I'm not saying it can't work out, but it is bad policy. Well, anyway, so the guy, well, I got married. And I put these in because I know cases, I've seen cases. I knew guys who got married for that reason. And it's a very bad reason. The ninth one, inadequate or defective motive, is to please parents. And there is often a lot of parental pressure. We often think that the real parental pressure is to not get married, and there is, often is that kind of pressure. But we don't realize how much pressure there is on some people by parents to get married. Well, honey, all your sisters are married. They're, you know. Listen, I have seen mothers who have a good friend whose daughter or son got married. Then they had another good friend whose daughter or son got married, and all of a sudden it's time for their son or daughter to get married. Why? It's kind of like this. It's peer pressure. It's social acceptance one step removed. Well, honey, you know, when are you going to get married? All these others are married. To please parents. Now, that's a fine line to walk. We do, I think most of us, want to marry somebody who pleases our parents, right? But I have seen cases of real trouble where a man or a woman married somebody because, well, at least I knew that my folks would like them. They wanted me to marry them. That's an inadequate motive. Although we do want to please our parents by who we marry. Well, is that helpful? Did you get that out in front of you? Think about those things. You see, kids, most marriages don't work. And a lot of marriages that don't work never had a chance. Because the couple got married for some wrong reasons. And a marriage that doesn't work is not a good thing at all. Tell about an unhappy situation. It's a marriage that doesn't work. Okay. Anybody else? Anything you want to say before we leave this topic?
Marrying the police parents, is that what they used to do in the old days? The
wasn't quite the same. There they didn't have much choice. I see your point, but you see the marriages weren't very good either. Very often, the fact they didn't get divorces don't mean the marriages were better. But the marriages tend to be more stable because you see what you're dealing with here, Jim, is what's called cultural expectations. That is, our culture creates expectations, and a couple who got married, say, in the old days, with an arranged marriage. They were not frustrated by certain things because they never expected certain things. It never occurred to them, cultural expectations. But in our culture, where we have certain expectations of marriage, and that we have this great freedom to choose, and this equality of sexes, then it becomes a more important factor. You understand my answer? It's a good question. Okay. We'll take our break and then we'll continue with the responsibilities of marriage. We're going to talk about finances later on, family budget. Am I ready financially? Now, let me just say here that while we're going to talk about family budgets, this is an important consideration. Somebody said, well, two people can live as cheaply as one. That's true, only half as long. One of the things we're going to say, come back to when we come back to budget, is that it's amazing how many marriages are broken up by money problems. And it is not smart to get married when it's very clear that at that point in life there's not enough money coming in to support the home. Other romantic notions aside, the first of the month takes the moolah, doesn't it? And you can't tell the bill collectors or the bank, well, but look how much we love each other. Aren't we a cute couple? You tried that. Scott Probaugh tried that, but it didn't work.
He said, no, you're not. Okay. And they were looking for one. Mm-hmm.
Are we ready to assume, now listen, to assume the financial responsibilities of marriage means two things. Number one, it means to simply have resources, to have an income. Secondly, it means have the demonstrated ability to control the income. And let me say this, that the major cause of money problems in marriages, especially new marriages, is not the inadequate resources, it's the inadequate control of the resources. Now, this gets very complicated. For instance, a lot of people have no couples. People grow up in homes where they were never taught financial responsibility for all kinds of reasons, and they have to learn it the hard way. For instance, one of the reasons I don't believe in giving children credit cards, I let my son use my gas credit card once in a while when his car is empty and he's broke. But I know kids whose parents gave them credit cards and they only saw one side of it. They saw the part where you went out and put down the plastic and took the goodies home. They didn't see the part when you had to write the check and pay for it. Right? And so they just really didn't understand. They had no concept of it. Concept of budget, concept of self-denial, concept of control. So there is this thing of being financially ready for marriage. Any questions on that? I'm going to give you an example of kind of a problem that can come from poor planning. You have two incomes. Now, we can live on that. You get married, a year and a half later, you got a baby, you know, and you only got one income, and it creates real problems. So it takes a responsibility. One of the things I really think I've noticed is that some of the way couples, people who are already married, when they come to Bible college, already have a family, really have to be good at this. And I think it's good. I think I'm good at it very often. Really good at making ends meet, as we say. Amen. Thank you, fellas. That's exactly right. And it goes to garage sales. My wife is very religious. She thinks it's immoral to sign a demon possession to pay the full retail price of anything. She really does.
been the salvation of our home sometimes, our budget anyway. You know, see coupons, everything on coupons. You think, you know, there's coupon, I can remember our first marriage, my wife learned to make fried bread. We couldn't afford store-bought bread, and she'd fry bread. And I really grew to hate fried bread. But simple, pardon? Flour and whatever fried. I'm not a gourmet cook. Okay, financial responsibility. Now, one of the problems that's created by this, I'm talking still on the subject, it's created by this longer age span now, people getting married older, is that it's hard to shift from a single budget to a married budget, especially if you've been on your own for a while, especially for a man who's been a bachelor and his money has been his money. And if he wanted a car, he went out and got it. And then he gets married. And it's hard to change gears financially. It's hard to back up. And it's hard to change gears financially. For men or women, it's very tough. One of the hardest things for couples who come to Bible college, they've got a family, some of them have to back up financially. And it's hard to do. And let me tell you this: financial worries can ruin a marriage. They'll sap your energy, short circuit you. It causes a lot of arguments. You get things like this: "Well, honey, we haven't been out for 6 months. Yeah, and you bought this and you bought this." Or you get this in Bible college too. You bought another book. Tell me you didn't buy another book. I've got ragged underwear and you're buying books or something, you know. Well, it's very important. We're gonna talk about family budget later. Are you emotionally ready? Are you financially ready? Are you emotionally ready for marriage? By that I mean, can you shift gears from I to we? Can you live the we life? Selfism is the primary marriage killer. You got that? Selfism is the primary marriage killer. Say we. We. Are you ready to think we? Now. Pardon? Yes, them against us. We're holding our own against them. I'm very serious about it. Can you think? I'm talking about a genuine thing. It's the capacity, the phenomenon of thinking we, the way you think. And many couples are. The number one marriage killer is where you got one or both of thinking I. Feminism really just hurts marriage. And the worst aspects of feminism, there's some good aspects of feminism, couple three. But the bad aspects of feminism, which outvote the good, is that it elevates the I. Secondly, the responsibility of the mate's well-being and happiness. Are we emotionally ready to take responsibility for our mate's well-being and happiness? Being married means to take that load. Take responsibility for their happiness. Third, the selflessness and wisdom required to properly rear children. If there's any business that is the we business, that's not the self business, is having children and raising them. And we're going to come back to that later. Financial, emotional preparation. How about spiritual preparation? Are we ready to view marriage as a stewardship? That is, our mate and our children belong to God. We are taking care of them for Him. We are preserving them for Him. We are training them for Him. And here is, this is very, very important, especially the Bible college students. Does your prospective mate have an independent commitment to God? I want to talk about this, an independent commitment to God. Or is their commitment to God derivative from, does it derive from you? Is it derivative or is it independent? You see, let's just be very honest. Some Bible college students come to Bible college, meet the requirements, and graduate and never have a genuine commitment to God. That's a minority, a small minority. But it happens, and you know it happens. I have on occasion refused to sign diplomas. Not very many occasions. But many diplomas I've signed, I've had to force myself to do it. There are times almost when I wished I was a drinking man. I've never had a drink in my life. And a couple of times I wish I had a stiff drink before I could make myself sign it. I would never drink, but there are a few things in life that might force me to it, and that's one of them. As if anything would. I just hate to be sober when I'm doing this. Why? Because I'm signing a diploma that I know, when it talks about character and commitment, it's a complete lie. They have fulfilled the purposes for which this school was started, only in a technical sense. Now, don't marry that person if you are interested in serving the Lord. Why? Because if you're going to listen to me, I don't care how dedicated you are. If you want to be in ministry, your mate has to have their own commitment to God. It will not work. It will not work. That is, one thing I always appreciate about my wife, she had made a commitment to the kingdom, to full-time Christian service, that had nothing to do with me. It just happened that we worked our commitments out, our mutual commitment out together. In other words, I was always glad that I was engaged to a girl, almost engaged to a girl. I'd gone with a girl for a couple of years, and we had planned to get engaged, and she was a very nice young lady, and I think she would have made a real good wife, a very good wife. And we were going to go to Bible college, and then for a year or two, and then get out of work. We broke up in the summer before my freshman year. We didn't have a fight. She just realized that the only reason she was coming to me, not that she wasn't a Christian. She's been a very fine Christian and, you know, served in the church, played a piano for a church in Indiana for years, very fine person. But she realized that she was going to Bible college only because I was. And that she did not want to be a preacher's wife. Really. And she was smart enough to recognize that, and we talked it over, and we decided that then we called it off, and she married some guy and has been a very good servant in the church. But I thought she was smart, you know. We just and saying, look, I let's be honest. And so now, I'm talking about two things, really. It's one thing about an independent commitment to God and an independent commitment to ministry. The kind of ministry we're talking about. But if you're going to have a ministry, make sure your mate has their own, because they're going to need it. Yours will not sustain them. You got that? Yours will not sustain them. When the going gets rough, you're going to find the pressures. I'll just give a word of personal testimony. The kind of life I've lived, I've always lived, especially since I into the teaching ministry, where you're traveling, preaching. And if you don't have a wife at home who's in full sympathy with that kind of ministry, you cannot carry on. It just creates real problems. You understand that? Make sure they have their own commitment to God. That it does not feed off of yours. Because, listen to me, you'll run dry. And it'll cause trouble. Any comments on that? Yes.
This kind of relates to the question I posed to the devotional one, can I ask you that again?
No, we're going to come to that and marry him. They can live that long?
Yeah, but just very quickly, if you have a strong devotional life, even when you're married, and can you strengthen that relationship that you
yes, it does. Just, because we're talking about what I mean by devotional life, not just having devotion. One thing, a lot of couples have devotion, not having devotional life. I know couples have devotion as a prelude to making out. And, you know, they're not devotion, it's just devotions. Kind of like a liturgy. But it's like you know, for what we're about to receive, we should be thankful. Like saying grace before a meal or something. But that really, I'm glad you raised the question. It's a good question. That's your first this year. That's a good question. Listen to me. The fact that you have devotions together while you're engaged does not mean that you have that your mate has independent commitment. It may or that has nothing to do with it. It may or may not mean that. It's not. It does not necessarily mean that. Anybody can pray and read the scripture. Well, but it can be strengthened yet. I'm not saying they're not connected. I'm simply saying one's not a guarantee of the other. I think there were couples in Winston, Linda and I were going to Bible college who spent a good deal of their time in the car praying and doing whatever else they did. And that was sort of their favorite indoor sport. We had some of the most devout couples. Never amounted to anything in the ministry. That didn't mean a thing. Well, I don't want to be indelicate in this, but I'm deadly serious about this. It's very frustrating to me to spend 4 years of my life teaching somebody, man or woman, to be a servant of Christ, and to see them go out and utterly fail very early because their mate had never had any real intention of paying the kind of price you got to pay to do kingdom work. And I'm not making that up. That happens. Wish I were making it up. Okay. I hope you understand how important that is. Anybody want to say anything further? I don't mean to be too grim here. Okay, we move on to D. Is the prospective mate in harmony with one's chosen life's work? We've already approached this. Spiritual harmony? That's what I was talking about above. Emotional harmony? What do I mean by that? Well, let's just use an example. If you're going to be a preacher, is your wife emotionally equipped to be a preacher's wife? She may be dedicated to God, but is she emotionally stable? You got that? Is she going to be able to handle it? Or you? Emotional harmony. Let me say this: you get somebody who's now. This is a tricky thing. Let me say again what I've said before: that every marriage has its own chemistry. If you get somebody, you get one person who is always on their high horse, and somebody who isn't, somebody who's super calm, you put them in a ministry situation, and you can get some real instability. Things are going to keep things off balance. For instance, I could talk good examples. There must be emotional harmony. You know what I mean by that? You want to question that before I leave the point? Well, harmony of desire. That is, do you want the same kind of life? I'm not talking about whether you believe in God or not, or whether you want to serve God. Do you want the same kind of life? For instance, do you want the life? If we're going to be a missionary, for example, that's a very specific example. But there are many others less spectacular. That is, a woman, if you're going to be a missionary, make sure you marry a woman who wants that kind of life. If you're going to be a preacher, make sure you want to marry a woman who wants that kind of life. That is, wants to serve. The question is not whether you want to serve God or not. Do you want to serve God in that way? Do you want, for instance, do you want a large family or a small family? You get a you know, guy married, he wants six kids and she wants one. You need to talk about that before the marriage. Not listen. Does she want to live in a big house and he doesn't? Or maybe the other way around? You realize that a lot of couples get in trouble because one partner wants to live at a level, financial level, the other partner doesn't want to worry about it. What part of the country do you want to live in? Now, I'm not saying you have to agree on all this. There's give and take. But it's going into marriage. You get some girl who says, I was born in Florida, I love Florida, and I'm going to live in Florida no matter what. And he's from Montana, or Timbuktu, you know, or somewhere. And he says, I love the mountains, and I couldn't think of living anywhere else. Well, you're going to be the same people after you get married. The wedding vows aren't going to change that. And then you get, then what are you going to do? Well, he thinks, when I get married, then I'll change her, or she says, I'll change him. Harmony of desire. I'll give another example. What about the relationship with the in-laws? Where he says, honey, or thinks, me not tell her, we get married, we're going to spend every Sunday afternoon with my folks, and my brothers and sisters, and all the cousins, and play together, and we've always done that. Part of our family tradition. And she says, well, I like to have my weekends to myself. My idea of a good Sunday afternoon is that's my time to be alone and have to be have my own time. What are you going to do? Harmony, simple harmony of desire. And you have to work things out. But you need to lay the groundwork before you get married. Now, and we could give it some very concrete examples. He said he wants to go to graduate school, and she's opposed to it. What are you going to do? Harmony of desire. You can't. Now, listen to me. I'm not saying you can get all this worked out before the marriage, but I think you need to communicate and get some guidelines set before you make major decisions like that. Harmony of personality traits. Now again, there is a we're not looking for a cookie cutter type of marriage. That'd be very boring. And I've seen people who were vastly different have excellent marriages. It's a chemistry. So I'm not saying marry somebody who has the same personality traits you do. I'm simply saying be aware that personality traits are a factor in marriage. And I've seen some of the strangest marriages were great marriages. We got a family joke called "Isn't That Right, Sherwood?" Remember that? We met this couple one time on vacation, and Leslie dated the boy for a little while. But he was not the son. He dated the son, not the man. Yeah, but the parent. It's really funny. The father was the man, was just kind of calm and quiet, and the mother, his wife, was just bubbly, you know, just talking all the time, you know, and he'd sit there, and he'd just talk, and he'd never say a word, you know, and ever so often she didn't know, she'd say, isn't that right, Sherwood? He'd say, yeah, and then she'd go on, you know, and just talk, you know, and then, isn't that right, Sherwood? Yeah, and so it's a joke of my wife. When I'm sitting, when she's talking, and I'm just sort of sitting there, she'll say, isn't that right, Sherwood? I'll say, yep. But these people are entirely different, and they were just happy as clams.
you know, they just did fine because she wanted to talk and he didn't care. He didn't, so he's just like, he let her do all the talking for him. He's not happy. All he had to do, every so often, she would raise the flag. Isn't that right, Sherwood? He'd say, yep, and he'd fulfill his responsibilities. You know, he was done. You know, he got by chief. And so she liked it, and he liked it, apparently. I've seen the strangest combinations have good marriage. And I've also seen strange combinations destroy marriage. Or make marriages very weak, contribute to the destruction of marriage. Simple personality traits. And it can be big things like whether somebody's an optimist as opposed to a pessimist. You let an optimist, a natural optimist, marry a pessimist, and they can balance each other and have a good marriage. Sometimes they can pull them apart. One marriage partner, they'll try anything once. Another marriage partner won't try anything at all. If you get somebody who's... Or simple things like... And this would overlap with harmony of desire. You see an outdoor person, she's an indoor person. You think about that.
Nighttime or morning.
Oh, listen, that's a very important... But people change, you know, nighttime or morning person. It's interesting that... It's interesting how people change. For years in our marriage, I'm a morning person, always have been. You know, I get up in the morning and look out, world, here I come. And my wife is more of a morning person than she used to be. But in our young marriage, during the younger years, she is a night person. And we had to be aware of that. At 10 o'clock, I'd be done for the day. I'd been up since 4:30 or 5, and I was washed out, and I was in bed asleep. And she was, that's when she liked to do her housework. You know that. Kids were in bed, when the kids were little. Kids were in bed, and she'd clean, and, you know, many a times I've gone to bed, and she's cleaning and down the basement, washing clothes, and getting the house all over, and happy as a clam, you're enjoying herself, you know. Of course, the next morning, I get, you know, I'm up, and she's dead. Kiss her on the cheek and leave. And we had to be aware of that. In later years, when the kids got older, she didn't clean up that much anymore. But it was quite interesting. I can't tell you the times I've awakened at 3 o'clock in the morning and she'd be painting. You know, wasn't sleeping, painting, as I didn't have often. You know, always wanted to get this done. Of course, you know, when they're pregnant, they start nesting, and then it really gets crazy. But that's an unusual situation. Nesting? Well, a woman, just before she has her baby, usually goes on a cleaning binge. I didn't have to have the doctor tell me that the baby was going to be born in the next 24 hours or 36 hours. If I found my wife at 4 o'clock in the morning cleaning the top of the refrigerator, cleaning things that hadn't been cleaned, making sure all the clothes were washed. I mean, when she throws me out of the bed and takes the bed clothing and so she can wash it. Well, not that bad, but she's nesting. And I knew that it won't be long, we're going to have another baby. Did you ever hear that? But that's an unusual situation. Right, fellas? Did your wife do that? Yeah, that's what it is, but you recognize the phenomenon. They want to get everything. But that's an unusual situation. But you get this morning versus late, and all kinds of personality traits. We have to think about it. Okay, we look at general outlook on life, attitudes. I think we've said enough about that. Hobbies, art, music, recreation, dress. Now again, we do not call for uniformity. But for its own sake, but we call for awareness. For instance, now this is, and there are two ways to look at this. And it's again, this thing of chemistry, it always amazes me. Some couples have good marriages because they enjoy the same hobbies, let's say. Antique. They both love to go to garage sales or auctions and look for this rare antique, and they take it home and strip the wood and paint. And they have a good marriage because they have the same hobbies. Other couples have good marriages for the very reason that they don't have the same hobbies. And I said, because that is these are major contributing factors. That he has what he wants and she does what. But usually the couples that have these different hobbies, they have some basic things in common, some important things in common. And we had a couple that got, when I was going to Cincinnati Bible College, it was really funny. She was a little bit older, and he had been a bachelor for years. She was an unclaimed blessing, and he was, I forget what he was, but anyway, before they met each other, they were very critical of couples who would even walk around campus holding hands. They thought that was horrible. And there were, and all campuses have this problem of untoward public displays of affection. But anyway, they were very strong. But when they found each other, man, they were worse than anybody. Usually that way. Whenever you saw one of them, you saw the other. You talk about having a harmony of everything. I mean, they walked to class together. They did their homework together. They just together all the time. And I thought, well, when they get married, that'll be the end of that. But we bought a Volkswagen, and they had a Volkswagen, and there's only one place in town you get them serviced at that time. One morning I went out there to get my car serviced. And they were getting their car service, and they came together. After they were married, and sat together, and looked at the same magazine while their car's oil was being changed. And I used to see them at the laundromat. They would go to the laundromat together and sit there and watch their BVDs go round and around in the dryer. Just happy as clams. And so it didn't change. And I talked with my wife, and we decided that if we'd probably kill each other if we were together that much. That is, during the day, my wife and I are really glad to see each other at night, but she didn't want me around all day. That's one of the reasons I can't retire. I don't worry about retirement. I don't have any choice. Right. She doesn't, in other words, when she wants to clean the house and do her thing and do her work, she does not want me around most of the time. But if I haven't been around all week, she wants me around on the weekend. But this day, when she goes shopping, the last thing she wants is me with her. And when I go fishing, which I'm not going to do much anymore, I do not want my wife to go fishing with me. When I want to play basketball, I don't want her out there. She doesn't know what she's doing anyway. She beats me. And if she ever beat me, I'd die. You see what I'm saying? And she goes and does her thing. She and her sister want to go garage sailing. Go. I'll do my thing, you do your thing. You see it? And that's our chemistry. But there are some basic things we've enjoyed together. One of the things we really agree on is traveling. We've already agreed on that. We put our money in traveling rather than furniture. And we love that, and our family loves it. And so we don't mind Leslie, how many times have you been across the country in campers? Just many times. We have some great memories. We have a lot of other stuff. We had great memories. We're going to talk about that later. But my point here is that Linda and I had to agree on that. It's a very important thing. Because it was an expense. It was an investment of money and time and energy. So. You see what I'm saying? My opinion is that in most cases, a couple who does everything, when they get the car service together and go to the laundromat together, and I don't know, amazing. When they go out to eat, I can always tell a couple like this, not always, but most couples go out to eat, they go to a restaurant, they get a booth, they sit across from each other, not them, they sit on the same side of the booth, they only take up half the seat. Sit there and eat their macaroni in harmony. I always would fear that eventually one day one of them would take a shotgun and shoot the other one just out of mere principle after about 20 years of marriage. Anyway, but there must be, what I'm saying is, there must be some awareness of harmony in things like that. Not uniformity, but a harmony of spirit. Because, listen, if a couple has no mutual interest, it's very hard to have a good marriage. I think there ought to be exclusive interests, but there ought to be some mutual interest too. That if you don't like any of the same things, you ought to think seriously about getting married. Whether you ought to get married or not. You understand? If everything you like is what she doesn't like, and everything what she likes is what you don't like, if her idea of a good time is your idea of a wasted day, and she doesn't have, and there's no things you, nowhere, in other words, if there's no meeting ground, I think you need to be aware. Any comments or on this? Or? Yes.
Can I make a note of that? She doesn't do that.
I didn't know you could write. I'm going to take that out. Leave it in. Okay. Any questions on that? Some of you are married. Have you found this? Do you have areas of mutual interest? I'm serious. You share with us? For the benefit of those who aren't married or will be someday. In your marriage, do you find a thing that you really enjoy doing together that's besides sex? Mutual interest in getting out of school. Yeah. That's a dream. That's a goal. Yeah. What do you like to, in the way of hobbies or something like that? You guys are married. You like to travel?
If a family, like one of these guys sitting over here, has a kid, do you think that the woman's interest, if he's in school or something, is the mutual interest would be towards that kid?
That's a good question, and we're going to talk about that later. Let me say, too, that's right. Let me say that it is, a child is a natural mutual interest. That is not what I'm talking about here. Because I'm talking about that which is there before the child is born and will be there after the child is raised and leaves the nest.
Because, I was just saying that because if the child was the only thing that they had in common, after they did leave, they would be...
That's exactly right. And we're going to come back to that later. That if a child is the only mutual interest. And this happens to a lot of couples. As soon as the kids are raised, they get a divorce. Why? That was the only thing holding them together. And so we must avoid that.
I would say in response to him, I was one in class, but it was going to be our ministry. It was something we were working together with, and she knew that she would have to be a supporter to keep me going. And it's worked that way. Oh, be quiet. Thank you, Jim. And like I said, when that came along, I'm aware of joy.
Yes. The extreme of this, Tim, is where, and I've seen this happen, where couples feel like their marriage is failing, so they have a child to hold it together, to create a mutual interest. Now, if there's anything that's silly, that's it. All you're doing is bringing one more person into the misery, and creating misery for them. So I'm glad you made that distinction. That's good. Do you have harmony and views on child rearing? That is, if one's a disciplinarian and one is a libertarian, what are you going to do? You talk about it. For instance, if before marriage the guy says, well, I'm going to keep my children under control, or she may say that, and he said, and the mate says, well, I don't believe in spanking kids. I just think they ought to grow up, free spirited. Boy, listen. You need to think about that. You would, yeah. Views on handling money. We've talked about that already under financial. But do you share views on handling money? And I've talked about the unrealistic expectation of mirror image mating. What is mirror image mating? It's where two people get married because they're so much alike. They're just really mirror images. I think that that is unrealistic. It's unreal. Where it does exist, I don't trust it. And I think it is unrealistic to look for it. There's no such thing as a perfect match. We call it perfect mate. And we should not. That's, by the way, that's I think that's one of the futilities of modern computer dating. That's a ripoff. Where, you know, computer, you feed into computer, it comes out, this is just the right ideal mate for you. That is a little mechanical and artificial and unrealistic. And besides being unromantic, I don't think it works out that way. That is, I have seen some of the strangest, I have seen couples who were so much alike, they were so much alike, you would just swear they would have a great marriage, and they don't. And I've seen couples get married, and everybody around you says, surely not, they're not getting married. They're not anything alike. You don't tell me they're going to get married. And they have a great marriage. Have a great marriage? Why? It just works out. Okay. Any questions on that? Briefly, we'll finish this section today. The benefits of the wedding ceremony. I began my ministry in the 60s, where the marriage license was called just a piece of paper. Is that free? We'll live together. Why get married? A wedding license, a marriage license is just a piece of paper. I said, yeah, so is the Constitution of the United States. And the mortgage on your home is just a piece of paper. That doesn't say anything. As a matter of fact, our important commitments we put on paper with seals and signatures. Some pieces of paper are very important. And a ceremony is important. What is the wedding ceremony, the benefits of it? Well, it offers legal protection. I'm serious about that.
The ceremony itself doesn't offer.
Well, not this, I'm talking about getting married. The relationship is strengthened by public affirmation. I think it's good to stand before the public, before witnesses, and take your vows. It strengthens the relationship. What it does, it intensifies the sense of commitment. Ceremonies do that, and worship ceremonies do that. What do we do on Sunday? We go through a ceremony, if you want to call it that. We sing together, and we pray, and we go to the Lord, and we have the Lord's table, Lord's Supper. And it makes vivid to us, once again, our commitment. And a marriage ceremony does that. It's good. The ceremony properly recognizes the societal and familial aspects of the marriage. What do I mean by that? A marriage does not exist autonomously. That marriage is a part of society. I've already mentioned the part that you marry a family when you marry a person, and that you are a part of the whole. That is, marriages are not autonomous. They are not isolated. It's a part. Your marriage is a part of a fabric. And you better recognize that. Your marriage is a part of society, it's a part of a family, it's a part of a system. And the wedding ceremony affirms that. And last of all, commitment to marriage as a transcendent reality is reinforced. That is, we are committed a marriage ceremony with all of its splendor and its expense. The flowers and the music and the songs, it commits us to the ideal of marriage. That is, you understand, in a wedding ceremony, listen to me, in a wedding ceremony, not only is a couple married, but marriage itself is affirmed. Theologically affirmed, if nothing else. Where we say, here is a thing called marriage, we are honoring marriage. We are subscribing to the rightness of marriage. We are bowing down to the will of God in marriage. We are casting a vote for marriage itself, not just our marriage. and that's healthy.
Some of the new ceremonies, too, have, besides your regular traditional ones, incorporate a part of where you have a congregation affirm their or.
Yes, I've heard of it. I've never had one like that. You know what he's saying? Where you have the congregation get involved in the ceremony to affirm their support. That's good. I've never done that, but I think it's a good idea. That's all for today.